Thanks very much, Alain, for inviting us back to the Collège de France for another great meeting on complex glycans and things. Before I start, you may notice I've got a new address on the bottom of my startup slide. We started recently a project in the Czech Republic with Jessica Kwok, and this is being a very positive and interesting adventure, which I'll tell you more about over coffee, maybe. So I'm going to be talking about, as usual, plasticity, but from a slightly different aspect. So usually when I start up talking about plasticity, I introduce the concept to you, which I'll do again. Here is plasticity after a spinal cord injury, which is what I've worked at for many years. Here's the spinal cord, the motor neurons, the descending connections, and the injury. And by plasticity, it's a widely misused term, but what we mean here is sprouting of damaged and undamaged axons to make new circuits, bypass circuits, and changes in strength of existing synapses. But of course, plasticity means changes in connections in response to outside events. And it doesn't have to be a lesion, it can also be some sort of behavioral input, which we'll be talking about later. Now, at all points in this set of events, chondroitin sulfate proteoglycans play an important role in control. They're involved in glial scar formation at sites of injury. They're involved in controlling sprouting of axons after injury. They're involved in the control of synaptic spine dynamics, in other words, making new connections. And they're involved also in perineuronal nets. Now, I won't go through this diagram just now. I'll explain it to you later. The perineuronal nets that appear around inhibitory parvalbumin-positive interneurons primarily, of the sort that you've just been hearing about. The perineuronal net is a cartilage-like structure that surrounds the dendrites and usually the axon initial segment, particularly of this type of cell in the cortex, but other types of cell in other parts of the nervous system. So they form around parvalbumin-positive GABAergic inhibitory interneurons. They form at the end of critical periods of plasticity, and they're involved in the turning off of plasticity, the closure of critical periods at that time. If you remove the perineuronal nets, you can restore much of the plasticity that was lost at the end of critical periods. And the main active component doing this, we'll talk about later, are chondroitin sulfate proteoglycans. And the tool which is very useful for removing these structures is the enzyme chondroitinase, which digests the sugar glycan chains of these proteoglycans. And so we're going to be talking to begin with about experiments using this method of digesting perineuronal nets and proteoglycans. So I'm going to talk today about something I haven't spoken here about before, which is Alzheimer's disease and aging. Now, we started working on this for a number of reasons, partly opportunity. We have some great collaborators in Cambridge, Tim Bussey and Lisa Saxida, who work on memory and aging and memory mechanisms. Partly irritation, because it has been unbelievably difficult to get treatments for spinal cord injury into clinical trials. The economics are simply very unattractive to pharma companies, because there are thankfully very few patients who get it, and a one-off treatment for few patients is not attractive financially. So we've been looking for other ways in which to validate treatments that are useful for brain injury in conditions that are more common. Oh, thank you. Better one. And of course, nothing is more common than aging. Thirdly, of course, you may notice that some of us in this room are not quite as young as we used to be. And I take the view that aging is an unpleasant disease that we need to cure as quickly as possible. I'm married to a gerontologist who takes a different view, that it's a natural process, but she's all wrong. we need to cure this disease quickly. So if you're thinking about loss of memory in Alzheimer's disease particularly, or actually aging as well, you can think about it in two ways. You can think about curing the disease process, and that is the way that most Alzheimer's researchers think. They search for disease-modifying treatments. But you can also think of it as a lesion. Alzheimer's disease is a lesion that affects many neurons in the brain, and you can think about what you would call a cognitive enhancer through reactivation of plasticity. So you would treat Alzheimer's disease just like you would treat any other sort of damage to the nervous system. Now, I have trouble getting this idea through to Alzheimer's researchers, because for them, this is a kind of religion. But most of us, I think, can see that, actually making the brain work despite the fact that it has Alzheimer's disease would be a useful thing to do and would delay the onset of disease symptoms for a long time, probably long enough that you won't get the condition. So this involves thinking about memory, and that gets you into memory mechanisms and memory models. Now, this is another contentious area. Unfortunately, we have some very good collaborators. We've been working on a number of memory models, and most of them are here. These are the areas of the brain that the memory models test. These are the different models, and these are the behavioral tests. So what you find if you start trying to publish in this field, is you send off a paper with a nice result in a memory model, and you get back a reviewer's comment saying, this is very interesting, but they used the wrong memory model. This model has no translational value. So it said they should have used this model, and that tells you exactly who the referee is, because that, of course, is the model they use in their lab. But nevertheless, I'm not going to go through all of these because it would just take too long. I'm going to focus on one particular sort of memory which is very useful for this kind of research, which is object recognition memory, which is very useful because you know exactly which part of the brain is involved in mediating it. It's the perirhinal cortex. And it also involves a fairly short test, which can be done in the context of Alzheimer's disease and rapid decline of function in transgenic animals. Some of these tests take months, and of course, in months, the animal's already dead, so this is not very useful. So you need a quick test, and you need to know which part of the brain is involved so you can inject it or do things to it, and object recognition memory ticks all these boxes. So we have results in most of these tests, but I'm going to focus for this talk on object recognition memory. This is what it looks like. It's a very simple task. You put animals in a Y maze, and you give them two objects to look at. And one of them is familiar, and one of them is either familiar or novel. Here's a novel object. And all you do is, mice and rats are novelty detectors. They like things that are novel. And basically, you time the amount of time they spend interacting with the familiar or the non-familiar object. And from that, you can tell whether they think it's novel or whether they think it's familiar. Now, when you do this to a mouse, you expose them to a novel object for 5 minutes. They remember for about 12 hours. So here's this task again, the Y maze, the two objects. And this is what you normally see. If you look at the blue bars, they remember it. And 3 hours, they still remember it a bit. 24 hours, they have completely forgotten. So when we started this research, I went to Tim and Lisa, and I said, look, memory is a form of plasticity. We know something about plasticity. Let's do some experiments together. Let's treat the perirhinal cortex with chondroitinase, or do something else we'll come to later, and see what happens, because I bet these animals will have something funny about their memory. Now, what we expected, because we were increasing plasticity, is the animals would learn very quickly and forget very quickly. In actual fact, what we saw was quite different. They learn fine. In fact, they learn very well and quickly, but they remember normally at 3 hours, but they still remember at 24, 48, 96 hours. So what we're seeing is not a rapid extinction of memory, we're seeing a prolongation of memory retention. So this was unexpected, but as you'll see, it actually makes sense in terms of the biology. So it's not terribly useful to us to be able to remember things for a long time. Do you really want to remember where you parked your car 3 years ago, or which your hotel room was in 1983, you know? It's good to be able to forget things. But if you happen to be someone who has no memory at all, it would be great to get some back again. So from this prolongation of memory, we said, well, how about testing some pathology? Let's look at an Alzheimer's disease model. Now, it turns out that the Alzheimer's disease model that works best for this is a tauopathy model, in which the mice express a mutant form of human tau, which is responsible for a familiar Alzheimer's disease-like condition. The A-beta models do not show a very reliable loss of memory with age. So if you look at these animals, you see hyperphosphorylated tau. This is 1 month of age. 3 months of age, which is the age we're going to be looking at mostly. They haven't lost any neurons. The number of neurons is the same, but you can't see from where you're sitting. But many of these neurons are dystrophic. They have wobbly dendrites, and they are affected by the disease. If you wait longer, 5 months, 6 months, many of the neurons have started to die. So let's look at this condition with proteoglycans and with perineuronalettes in mind. So we're going to do the same task again. These are the objects we use. So we'll look first of all at the transgenic P301S mouse and look and see at its loss of memory. So at 3 months, memory is pretty normal. At 4 months, they can't remember much. 5 months, they can't remember anything at all. So basically, they lose their memory between 3 and 4 months in this particular background. You can do a similar experiment by injecting the tau, mutant form of tau, with a virus into the perirhinal cortex. Remember, we know the area of brain that this type of memory responds to. And over time, again, as the neurons become dystrophic, they lose their memory. So these animals have profound memory loss. So can we also get this back into the same area of biology as we've been talking about, proteoglycans and perineuronal nets? Well, let's inject the perirhinal cortex now with chondroitinase to remove the perineuronal nets to digest the proteoglycans. And in this situation, here's our one-hour memory. These animals have, as I say, a profound memory loss. They can't remember, but you inject chondroitinase and their memory comes back almost to normal after 1 hour's delay and after 3 hours' delay. So the answer is you can restore memory back to normal pretty much in this model at 3 months of age. Of course, if you go longer and longer, the brain becomes more and more damaged and eventually you can't restore it any longer. But nevertheless, for a fairly severe memory deficit, you can restore it. Unfortunately, chondroitinase is absolutely not a treatment for Alzheimer's disease. So first of all, it doesn't last very long. Remember, we're digesting perineuronal nets and glycans. They do come back. So you see an effect at 3 weeks. At 6 weeks, it's not significant any longer. So you're really getting about 3 or 4 weeks of recovery of function. And of course, chondroitinase spreads for about a centimeter. So in the context of a human brain, you would have to make 100 or so injections every 4 weeks, and this really is not going to happen. But nevertheless, it demonstrates to us the principle that this area of biology is relevant to memory and to restoration of memory after Alzheimer-like conditions. So let's now think about, can we relate this set of events to perineuronal nets? At the moment, all I've shown you is that chondroitinase restores memory. Now, proteoglycans are in perineuronal nets, but they're also 98% of them in the sort of general extracellular matrix goo that surrounds all neurons. So can we bring this back to perineuronal nets? Well, in order to do that, we first of all need to understand the structure, which we worked out some time ago. So here is the surface of a neuron, and in order to get a net, you need a pericellular matrix. And the backbone of that is hyaluronan, a repeating disaccharide, which is produced by hyaluronan synthase. And the parvalbumin neurons express this enzyme. Most of the proteoglycans have a hyaluronan binding site at one end, and that's stabilized by these pink blobs here, which are called link protein. And unless you have a link protein, you don't have a stable association between the proteoglycans and the hyaluronan. And then to make the tertiary structure, you also have tenascin, which is a glycoprotein, bound to the other end of the molecule in many cases. So this forms a stable cartilage-like structure. Now, as with cartilage, if you take away these link proteins, this binding is unstable and you no longer get a perineuronal net, or you get a very attenuated one. So here is a knockout of the link protein. Here's a normal perineuronal net. This is what you see in the knockout. It's not completely absent. That's probably aggrecan you're seeing there surrounding these neurons, but nevertheless, it's very much attenuated. So this does not affect the 98% of proteoglycans that are not in perineuronal nets. So all the proteoglycans are still here in the brain. It's just they're no longer concentrated in this perineuronal net structure. So this allows us to ask the question, does a perineuronal net do anything? Now, we know this from various experiments, from ocular dominance plasticity and so on, but let's now look at the absence of perineuronal nets and its effects on memory. So we're going back to the same memory task, and remember that in normal animals, wild type, memory is forgotten by 24 hours. Now, in the link protein knockout, we see exactly the same effect as we saw with chondroitinase. We see a prolongation of memory out to 96 hours and beyond, which looks exactly the same as the result we saw with chondroitinase. Not only that, if we take these animals and we now digest the other 98% of the proteoglycans that are not in perineuronal nets, we get no further effect. So I think we have to conclude that this effect on memory is through the proteoglycans in perineuronal nets. So let's now start to try to do some explanation. So for this, I'm going to rely very much on the work of Flavio Donato and Pico Caroni, because for us, this makes a lot of sense. I don't know how people in the audience feel about this model, but for us, we like it very much. So first of all, to make a memory, Pico has worked in the hippocampus, and he's worked on different sorts of memory, but nevertheless, what he's published is this, that here's your baseline circuitry. You have some VIP neurons projecting inhibitory connections to the parvalbumin-positive interneurons, which have a perineuronal net surrounding them. In order to make a memory, you have an increase in the number of inhibitory synapses from the VIP neuron, which decreases the activity of this parvalbumin interneuron. It decreases the parvalbumin level, decreases the GAD level, and it decreases the firing rate of the neuron, and that decreases the inhibition of the cortical circuit that it supplies. So in other words, you're increasing the excitability of a cortical circuit through the build-up of inhibitory synapses on the dendrites of the parvalbumin neuron. Now, when you give chondroitinase, it has exactly the same effect. You're making the perineuronal net more permissive, we'll come back to this, and you then see, even without a memory event going on, more synapses formed on the dendrites. So this, I think, is probably the mechanism, and we'll come back to it again, behind what we're seeing here. We're seeing chondroitinase easing, making it easier to form new synapses, making it easier to form memories that are stable. So one of the things that that Pico and Flavio published was that they saw a decrease in parvalbumin levels after a memory event and after chondroitinase. This was in the hippocampus. We see exactly the same in the cortex. If you look here, this is the number of strongly parvalbumin-positive neurons. It goes down at 6 months of age. It goes down at 20 months of age, which we'll come back to. So here's a simple piece of logic for us. Perineuronal nets contain high concentrations of proteoglycans. Chondroitinase digestion has the same effect as lack of perineuronal nets. So the nets must be the target of chondroitinase, and it must be those proteoglycans that are involved in plasticity. Chondroitinase digests the glycosaminoglycan chains, so it must be the glycosaminoglycan chains that restrict plasticity. In other words, we're into the area of glycobiology, which some people like and many people don't. So I'm going to give us a bit of very simple glycobiology. So a proteoglycan looks like this. There are many different types, but all of them are protein cores with sugar chains attached to them in varying numbers and lengths. And these sugar chains are sulfated at various positions. So they're sulfated primarily at the 4 position, which is called chondroitin sulfate A, or the 6 position, which is chondroitin sulfate C. And there are some disulfated forms which are at much lower concentration. But we're going to focus on 4 and 6 sulfates. So by sulfating the chains, you give them a charge structure because the sulfate groups are very negative. And these are 3 different binding sites on heparin sulfate chains. That's an FGF binding site, thrombin binding site, herpes virus binding site. The only thing that differs is the position of sulfation. So it's the sulfation events that give function to the chondroitin sulfate chains. Now, we can think of sulfation as a sort of subtle event, like I've just shown you, producing complex charge structures and binding sites. But there are also some more general rules. And one general rule is the difference between 4 and 6 sulfated glycans. So basically, 6 sulfated glycans are good. 6 sulfated glycans promote regeneration and plasticity. 4 sulfated glycans are inhibitory. I'll show you some results in a moment. So just try and remember, 4 bad, 6 good. Now this is important because the sulfation patterns change during development and aging. This is one of Hiroshi's slides from long ago, looking at the change in sulfation patterns during embryonic development. So this is the overall quantity of glycan, which decreases enormously over embryonic development. You can see early embryos are just full of gooey extracellular matrix. But when Hiroshi looked at the proportion of 4 and 6 sulfated, this is 6 sulfated, that's 4 sulfated. Mostly in early embryogenesis, it's 6 sulfated, but the ratio starts to change as time goes along to birth. This is chicks. If you now look postnatally, and we look here at the level of 6 sulfation, at the time of birth, 18%. At the critical period, still 12%. But after the critical period, most of the 6 sulfated glycan has disappeared. And we would expect that to mean that the glycan, that the proteoglycans become more inhibitory, less permissive. Now, even worse, we've recently been looking at aging, and even this small quantity of 6 sulfated glycan more or less disappears as you get to aging in both mice and rats. So this is 18 to 20 months. Suddenly you basically lose all your 6 sulfated glycan. And of course this will mean that the proteoglycans become yet more inhibitory as we become older. So this is very bad, and as you will see in a moment. So this leads us into thinking about aging. So remember, 4 sulfated glycans bad, inhibitory, axons won't grow over them. 6 sulfated good, axons will grow. We made a few years ago, by mistake, the least plastic, least regenerative animal there's ever been by knocking out the 6 sulfa transferase that is responsible for most of the 6 sulfation in animals. When we did that, we saw complete absence of regeneration. This was in the nigrostriatal pathway, and complete absence of plasticity. So let's think about aging now. What I've told you is that as we become aged, we lose the 6-sulfated glycan in our central nervous system. And if we look at the properties of this glycan, if we extract it from the perineuronal nets, and then we do a simple axon growth assay, which is what this is, we find that axons will grow a bit on youngish proteoglycan. That's that point, that point, and that point. But when you get to age, 20 months, 18 months of age, then the perineuronal net glycan has become very much, much more inhibitory, we think, because it has lost its 6 sulfation. So let's think about aging, and there's a lot of things we don't know about aging. Just some of the questions that come to mind are up here. It's a progressive loss of memory function and memory retrieval. When does it start? When is plasticity involved in preserving brain function during aging? Would more plasticity be good? And would lower plasticity lead to earlier memory loss? Well, I think we can now answer some of these questions, at any rate, if you happen to be a mouse and you happen to be doing the object recognition task. we have two sort of images of aging in our mind. Well, most of us have one image of aging in our mind, which is that here's neuronal dysfunction, that we're absolutely great, everything goes along perfectly, till we hit about 98 years old and suddenly things become less good. So that's a comfortable model, but actually most of the evidence points to something that's much less comfortable, which tells us that everyone in this room is already senile. Because actually the changes, the neurological changes that are associated with aging begin with adolescence in many cases and progress gradually throughout life. So we'll address which of those might be true in a moment. So first of all, have we got an animal model of memory loss in aging? Yes, this is quite easy to do. If you take the object recognition task, you take 18 month plus animals, 18, 20, 24 month old animals, apart from the fact that it costs you a fortune in your animal house, these animals show a profound loss of memory in the object recognition task at this kind of age point. So you've got an animal model that you can work with. Secondly, you can try and put this in the context of plasticity, proteoglycans, perineuronal nets to see if this is relevant by doing the simple experiment of injecting chondroitinase into the perineuronal cortex in these aged mice. And what you find when you do that is you can restore memory retention to normal levels in sort of 6-hour memory, but you can't actually get the increase in memory at 24 hours that we saw in some of the younger animals. So a partial restoration of memory, certainly. But here's where it gets more interesting. So I asked the question, would more plasticity be good? So here's an animal with more plasticity. It's the link protein knockout animal that I showed you earlier, which does not close its critical periods, which does not turn off plasticity during normal development. And we can age these animals, and we can ask, do these animals lose their memory at 18, 20 months, like normal animals do? Well, the answer is they don't. No, they have completely normal memory. We've kept some now beyond 2 years, and these animals have great memory, at any rate in this task, for as long as we can keep them alive. So they don't have age-related memory loss if they have enhanced plasticity. Now, this is where it gets bad. So we can now ask the opposite question. If you have an animal with low plasticity, what happens to its memory? So these are the animals with the knockout of 6-sulfation through the 6-sulfur transferase knockout that I showed you earlier. The animal I said had low plasticity, low regeneration. Now let's look at their memory. So here is normal animals, the pale bars, and here is the knockout animals, and look at 11 weeks and 13 weeks, they have completely lost their memory. So these are teenagers, right? So if you don't have plasticity, at a very early age, memory is lost in this particular type of memory. So this is very uncomfortable, isn't it? It means that all of us basically have started to age. We're all relying on plasticity to keep our memory going during these aging processes, if this is generalizable. But now let's come back to aging again and proteoglycans. What I've been telling you is that something very bad happens to our perineuronal nets as we get old, which is the small amount of 6-sulfate that maybe is responsible for keeping our plasticity going during normal adulthood suddenly disappears, or almost completely disappears, as we get older. So could this be an explanation for memory loss during aging? In other words, could we be seeing something like this? So I've shown you this already, that a memory event involves increased formation of synapses on the parvalbumin interneurons. Could this be what's happening? That we're getting very, very inhibitory perineuronal nets, which are preventing the formation of new synapses and therefore the establishment of memory events. Yep, that this very inhibitory extracellular matrix could actually prevent the formation of memory through the prevention of formation of synapses. So the model here would be this, that here is the neuronal dysfunction, whatever it is, that we have during the aging process, that it starts during young adulthood and gradually progresses throughout life. But we do have level of retained plasticity. And so we can use this to keep adjusting the nervous system and keep our neuronal function going normally. But then something very bad happens to us, which is there's a final reduction in 6-sulfated glycan in the perineuronal nets, which become more inhibitory. And at this point, we decompensate. Plasticity is decreased. And the ability to form new memories is lost. So that's the model we've been thinking about, and it does make two fairly simple predictions. One is that if we take aged mice, blocking the inhibitory 4-sulfated glycosaminoglycans should restore memory, or restoring the level of 6-sulfated glycosaminoglycan should restore memory. So those are the two simple predictions. Now we've done this one, I'll show you, and we're sort of halfway through this one. So in order to block the inhibitory 4-sulfated glycan, we've been using an antibody. It's called CAT316. It's an IgM. It's not a very good antibody, but nevertheless, it binds fairly specifically to perineuronal nets, and it blocks the inhibitory activity. It blocks the inhibition through these glycans. So we haven't done the aging model yet, but we have done the Alzheimer model, and certainly we can restore memory using this antibody by blocking 4-sulfated glycan to these Alzheimer animals. We're doing the aged animals currently. But more importantly, let's replace the 6-sulfated glycan that was lost during the aging process. And we can do this quite easily by using a virus, an AAV vector, to overexpress this 6-sulfur transferase enzyme, and we can put it into the perirhinal cortex. And what we see when we do that is essentially we restore memory pretty much back to normal. So it looks to us as if, you know, what we're saying is at any rate partly true, that the change in the sulfation pattern of the glycans is very important in memory loss during aging, and also important as a way of restoring memory in things like Alzheimer models. So let's just think what's going on here. Let's start summarizing. How are we restoring function? How are we restoring memory in these different models? Well, I showed you the different sort of events behind plasticity earlier on. So let's think about the Alzheimer model. I think what we've got in Alzheimer's is many neurons that don't work very well any longer, and we need to bypass them. We need to make new circuitry to create new circuits. And the increase in sprouting we see after removing proteoglycans is probably important in this process. But also, we have the rather specific events via perineuronal nets. Now, I suspect that's the main mechanism behind the restoration of memory in aging, but it's also important probably in the restoration of memory in the Alzheimer model as well. So, how are we doing? Yeah. Let's just think a little bit about mechanism. We don't know very much about mechanism. We know a bit about OTX2, which I think we're going to hear about later, yeah? We've been working with Joost Verhagen on his favorite molecule, which is semaphorin 3A, not 3B, 3C, or 3D. He's not interested in those, only 3A. And semaphorin 3A is very interesting because it's expressed at high level in the adult nervous system. It's not just an embryonic guidance molecule. It's expressed in the cortex and other parts of the brain at high level, and so also other receptors. Now, it's expressed in many types of neuron, but if you actually stain for where it's gone to, it's all sequestered onto the perineuronal nets of the pavalbumin-positive interneurons. If you look at these interneurons, you can see the semaphorin following the perineuronal nets, surrounding the synapses and so on, in a very beautiful pattern. In other words, this molecule, this axon guidance molecule, which also has effects on synapse dynamics, is concentrated in perineuronal nets at exactly the place where memory events are controlled. We've been looking, or rather I should say that Tommaso Pizzorusso, who is here, is he? Somewhere here. Hello, Tommaso. This is the result that he sent me years ago, which hasn't quite been updated yet, Tommaso, and hasn't quite been published yet. Showing that when you block the effects of semaphorin 3A with a receptor body, a neuropilin 2 receptor body, you can restore, to some extent at any rate, ocular dominance plasticity. Now, we haven't done this yet in memory, but my expectation would be that when we do it, we would see that blocking the effects of semaphorin 3A would be a mechanism, a method, for restoring some of the memory function in aging and Alzheimer's. So finally, what we've done during this last few minutes together is to convince me, and I hope you as well, that the perineuronal net is a potential target for thinking about how to restore memory in Alzheimer's and aging. Now, this is a very unusual therapeutic target. Pharma companies don't like it because it's something they can't think about. But nevertheless, within it, there are many potential therapeutic targets. So I've talked about one of them, an antibody that recognizes the inhibitory 4-sulfated glycans, CAT316. We've been working with Hiroshi, who's talking later, with this antibody. And certainly this antibody does demonstrate that an antibody that recognizes 4-sulfated glycans potentially would be a useful treatment. This antibody itself is not useful because it's an IgM, and therefore we need to make a better antibody. We're also working on an inhibitor of this enzyme here, hyaluronan synthase. Now, it turns out there is, in fact, it's an over-the-counter drug in France, in Germany, in Japan, called 4-methylambiliferol, which it's not a very good pharmaceutical. It's a decoy, But nevertheless, it does have the effect of blocking some forms of this enzyme and blocking the formation of perineuronal nets, certainly in the spinal cord. We're not certain about the brain yet. And in the spinal cord, certainly, it can restore function after injury. So that's potentially a way to go. The RK peptide is something I think we're going to hear about later, which blocks the effects of OTX2. And we're also working on small molecule inhibitors of the... of the sulfur transferases, which make the inhibitory for sulfated glycans in the first place. So this potentially also is a route, but not an easy one. So the perineuronal net is full of targets if we can get some good pharmaceuticals. So let's just summarize. Chondroitinase in the damaged CNS, many types of function can be restored. Chondroitinase to the perirhinal cortex restores object recognition memory. Chondroitinase to other parts of the brain restores other sorts of memory, and it allows us to restore memory in tauopathy and aging. Link protein knockout is similar, which tells us that this is the perineuronal net which is involved. Animals with enhanced plasticity do not show age-related memory loss. This is good. While animals with reduced plasticity lose memory very early, that's very bad. In aging animals, there's a loss of 6-sulfated glycan from the perineuronal nets. This is associated with loss of plasticity, loss of memory. We replace the 6-sulfated GAGs and we can restore memory. And there are many potential treatment targets if we can get this to work. So I'll finish there. The person who's done almost all this work, this is her goodbye slide, is Sujong Yang, who works with us in the Brain Repair Center and also in Prague now. And she has been working with Lisa Saxida and Tim Bussey, who are our collaborators with memory models in the Department of Psychology, with Jessica Kwok, who's now at the University of Leeds, who's our glycan biology expert. Maria Spallantini produced the 301S model. The structure of the perineuronal nets, that was Daniela Carulli and Jessica. The spinal cord injury, which I haven't talked about, were these three. Sujong, the memory model. Semaphore in Gunnar Joost. Tommaso, all the physiology we've been doing on the effects of perineuronal nets, and Maria, the glycan model. So I'll stop there. Thank you very much indeed.